Exploring how we can transform our communities in the 21st century with the support of St Ives Chambers, RHE Global and Me Learning. Welcome. This is the Community Safety Podcast with your host, Jim Nixon.
Today, the Community Safety Podcast turns its attention to domestic abuse. My guest has been working in the field of domestic abuse for 23 years, and she's also a survivor of domestic abuse herself. This really is a must-to-listen episode, but please be warned, some of the content is upsetting and graphic. Please take a listen to a snippet of today's interview.
One night I went out, my friend said to me, come on, let's go out. You need to kind of clear your head. You need to just have a bit of normality. So my mum had my little girl. I went out, came back. She came back with me, picked my daughter up from my parents, came back to my flat. And I opened the front door. And as soon as I opened the front door, I just sensed he was in there, and I said to my friend, he's in here. And she laughed and said, don't be silly, just being paranoid. And went into what was our bedroom, asked my friend to open one side of our wardrobe unit, and she did. She was still laughing. Asked her to open the other side, and as she did, he jumped out and he had a knife.
It's now time for the Community Safety Podcast.
Welcome to the Community Safety Podcast. I'm your host, Jim Nixon. I've been working in community safety for over 25 years. This podcast will explore how we can transform communities in the 21st century. I'm delighted to introduce today's guest to Sharon Bryan. For the last 23 years, Sharon has worked in the field of domestic abuse. She's also the survivor of domestic abuse. In 2000, she joined the Women's Aid Federation of England Board of Trustees. In 2020, Sharon set up Sharon Bryan Consultancy, a community interest company. This involves running the Freedom Programme to women who have or are still experiencing domestic abuse. And then in January 2021, Sharon joined the award-winning National Centre for Domestic Violence, where she's Head of Partnerships and Development for Domestic Abuse Services. Welcome, Sharon. Thank you so much for agreeing to be a guest on the Community Safety Podcast.
Thank you for asking me.
It's brilliant to have you on board. We've been wanting to cover domestic abuse for a few weeks now, so it's fantastic having you on board. I always start off with my interviews because I think it's always important that the audience get to know a little bit about you before we get into the main part of the interview. So tell me a little bit about Sharon growing up and what life was like for you.
Oh, okay. So I grew up in Camberley, which is a town in Surrey. And I still don't really live that far away from Camberley. Had a pretty ordinary upbringing, I think. Parents didn't have much money, but, you know, we had, myself and my brother had what we wanted and what we needed. I went to school. Normal stuff, really. Nothing out of the ordinary, to be quite honest.
And what was it? What was it kind of like growing up in Camberley around that time? What was the community like?
I grew up on a council estate. My parents had got a house there before either my brother or I were born. My brother's 10 years older than me, and there were only kind of their row of houses when they moved in, but that quickly, the estate quickly expanded, and a lot of it was used for the overflow, from the London overflow.
Okay.
So a lot of the roads on the estate are named after London boroughs, like Mitcham Road, Sutton Road, Kingston, Wimbledon, and there was shops there, schools were all there, didn't really need to go off of the estate. It's still one of the biggest estates, but there's a lot of the properties have been bought now.
Yeah, it's interesting. I live on just outside a massive housing estate, and it was a London developer that came over into Birmingham in the 1930s, It's quite ironic that all of our streets as well are named after London areas. Right. Like you've got like Tottenham Crescent, Twickenham. You know, it's quite ironic actually. Yeah. But I always wondered why. And then my dad said to me, oh yeah, it's because this London developer came up in the 30s. So it's quite interesting you saying
that. Yeah, yeah.
So it's just quite a nice, normal childhood really.
Yeah.
With no, yeah, that's really good. Good to hear. Same as mine really. You know, mine was very similar, I think. Obviously, when I introduced you, I touched on the subject of you being a domestic abuse survivor,
mm-hmm.
and I just wanted to go into that in a bit more detail and just wondered if you would, you know, explain to the audience what life is like living with an abusive partner.
Okay, so I met my ex-husband when I was very young, when I was 17. And very quickly, it was quite an intense relationship. It very quickly progressed. And I met him in the summer of 1983. And we actually got married in April 1984. So I just turned 18. So it was very quick. Don't remember thinking that there was anything particularly odd about that at the time. I can remember quite a few of my mum's friends asking her if I was pregnant, but I wasn't. And we settled into married life. He very, very quickly became quite controlling, quite aggressive with me. And that kind of escalated really over a period of months. I had never experienced anything like that in my, in my childhood. My dad was a very gentle man, so I didn't really know. You know, he used to say sorry. Up until this point, he wasn't physically abusive, and I used to say sorry, and I used to forgive him. I fell pregnant with my eldest daughter. And she was born in August 1985. Very, very quickly after she was born, he became physically abusive. Remember that when she was about 3 weeks old, we were both been invited to this party, and I didn't want to go. I'd had a cesarean section. I didn't feel up to it. So he went, and at the time we were still living with my parents. We were waiting for the local authority to house us, and he didn't come back. It was very late. I called the house where he was at the party, and I could hear him in the background saying, "Tell her I'm not here," that sort of thing. And he came in about 2 o'clock in the morning, I guess. And I thought, well, you know, I'm not going to argue with him about it. It's late. My parents are in the room next door. The baby's asleep. And he came into the bedroom with a can of lager in his hand. And he started sort of trying to get me into an argument, which I wasn't playing party to. And then he just lifted the can of lager and poured it all over my head. So I had to get up, tried to get out, passed him to get to the bathroom. And at that point, he punched me in the stomach. I realise now that I probably should have ended things there and then, because I didn't, and because I forgave him, I then gave him the green light really to carry on with the physical abuse, which he did. And lots of things happened, and I was kind of experiencing that until 1987, and that was kind of when the big thing happened.
But just touching upon what you said there was that things kind of escalated once your eldest daughter was born.
Mm.
What do you think was the reason for that?
At the time, I didn't have a clue. I know now, obviously, having worked in the field for so many years, that it's about, about attention, about the abuser not feeling that they're not center of attention, feeling jealous almost, I guess. At the time, I didn't have a clue what it was about. So I think that he was just very kind of very put out that he wasn't the center of my world anymore.
Yeah, I've heard this a few times, and I saw this quite a bit when I was in the police. Went to quite a few domestics where a child had recently been born, and I have to say, in a lot of cases, it was the male partner that was obviously the abuser.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you're right. I think jealousy plays a big part. You know, one minute they're ultimately the only person in that partner's life or wife's life, and all of a sudden, you know, you've got another little bundle that you're looking after, mm-hmm. and your attention has to be drawn towards that new life, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yes, of course. Yeah. It was the physical abuse was getting pretty bad, and it got to a point where I knew I had to do something, and a neighbour of mine at the time had similar problems with her husband, and she said to me, "Why don't you go to solicitor that I went to, and talk to them about getting an injunction?" Didn't know what an injunction was. Didn't know anything about it. Didn't know anybody that was going through it. To me, I was the only person that was going through this. I didn't really understand it at all. I went to saw the solicitor, and she suggested, you know, definitely get a non-molestation injunction. But I wasn't prepared at that point to leave him. I guess it was, for me, it was the last ditch attempt to try and get him to change. So went to court, got an order ex parte. So he didn't know about it at the time. Process was very simple. But of course, I was at home when the process server came to serve it on him, which was the first he knew of it. And he just came into the living room and looked at me and read it, and he just tore it up. Meant nothing to him. And the violence didn't stop. And the order was for 3 months. And that was in around about the October, and the order expired around about the second week of the following January. During that 3 months, there was a serious incident where he actually broke my nose. And there were many, many incidents, but I think if somebody asks me what was the worst thing, I always think of the broken nose. Actually, it wasn't the worst thing. The worst thing was probably that he stabbed me. But for me, it was the broken nose, because that is the worst pain I have ever felt in my life. And again, I didn't report him. I was just too afraid to. And then on Christmas Day, December the 25th, about 2 o'clock in the morning, we'd been out. He'd been drinking. I was driving. My parents had our daughter. I actually lived on the same estate as them. And we got back to our flat, and he just said, "Get into the passenger seat." And he got into the driver's seat, and he took off onto the M3 all over the road. I was absolutely terrified. My daughter was in the back seat awake. He pulled into a service station, and basically he raped me. At the time, I didn't see it as rape. He was my husband, so I didn't see, you know, I didn't look at it like that. And I was going to leave that night, and we got home. I don't even know how we got home alive, because he was so drunk, but we got home. And I don't know, it was Christmas Day morning. Christmas tree was up, you know, picture the scene. And I thought, I can't do this. I've got nowhere to go. My parents didn't know anything. Didn't know he was hitting me, didn't know anything. So I thought, okay, I'm going to see this through until the new year, which I did. And it was terrible. The Christmas was awful. And then on January the 4th, I decided that's it. And to this day, Jim, I don't know why it was that day. I'd always thought it would happen the way it happened, but I didn't. I don't know why it was that day rather than a week later or a week before. I got up. He was due to go back to work. He said, "I'm not going." Ring up and tell him I'm not going. So I rang up, and his boss said, "Why isn't he coming in?" And I said, "Because he can't be bothered." And his eyes kind of snapped open, and I thought, oh God, this is it now. And he got up and he hit me, and then he went back to bed, and I thought, right, I've got to leave. This is it. I've got to do this now. Didn't know where I was going to go, but I threw some clothes into a suitcase in the same bedroom as he was, but he'd gone back to sleep, grabbed my daughter and got in the car and just drove, and actually ended up at my cousin's house in another area that he had never been there. So I knew that, I hadn't seen her for years, actually, but luckily she still lived there. And I knew he would never find me there because he'd never been there. And I phoned my solicitor and told her, look, you know, this has happened. He's breached it dozens of times. And she called the police. She pretty much took over, called the police, and the police came to my cousins that evening and took statements from me. I said to them, I told them what had happened at the service station. And one of the police officers said, that's rape, isn't it? I said, no, because he's my husband. And they said, no, but it is. And apparently because the non-molestation order prevented him from having his what was called conjugal rights, they were able to go ahead with that. But in the meantime, he went into court the next day, the family court. I had to go for the breach of the injunction. And he was sentenced to 2 months in prison, which everybody was really shocked about. Remembering this was 1987. My solicitor didn't think he would get a prison sentence, but he did. I knew. He looked across at me and just mouthed the words, I'll kill you. And I was absolutely terrified. And it didn't matter what the police said to me or my family said to me. I knew that he was going to do something. But he went in and he did a month of that, 2 months. And in that month that he was away, I started divorce proceedings, kind of trying to sort of like pick up the pieces. He came out after a month, and he was only out for about a week. He was taking no notice of the orders that were in place, taking no notice of the police actually gate arrested him when he came out and charged him with GBH. I think it was GBH of my nose. And also charged him with rape, which was the first time a husband had been charged of this. But he didn't take any notice. He still kept coming round. And then one night I went out. My friend said to me, come on, let's go out. You need to kind of clear your head. You need to just have a bit of normality. So my mum had my little girl. I went out, came back. She came back with me, picked my daughter up from my parents, came back to my flat. And I opened the front door. And as soon as I opened the front door, I just sensed he was in there. And I said to my friend, he's in here. And she laughed and said, don't be silly, just being paranoid. But it was kind of like, I always think it was like one of those horror films, but I was going around turning on all the lights, because in my mind I was thinking, nobody turns on the lights in these films. Like, I'm switching on all the lights. And went into what was our bedroom. And my little girl was just hovering around, really, and asked my friend to open one side of our wardrobe unit, and she did. She was still laughing. Asked her to open the other side, and as she did, he jumped out and he had a knife, and I fell back on the bed, and he brought the knife down, and I put my hand up to protect myself, and the knife went through my hand. And then as he came up again with the knife, she was behind him and she took the knife out of his hand. It was a split second thing. I didn't even realise that he'd stabbed me for what seemed like a long time, but probably was only a few seconds. And then when I looked down at my hand, I could see that he'd stabbed me and it was bleeding. And my friend rang the police. They came, and by this time he'd gone, he'd run off. And I still didn't tell him. I told him that he'd been to the flat, but I didn't tell him that he'd stabbed me. And I had my hand wrapped in a tea towel behind my back. And they went, and time went on, and I couldn't feel. I started to lose the feeling in my thumb. And my friend said, I need to take you to the hospital. This isn't right. So she took me to the hospital with my little girl. It was in the middle of the night by this time. And they had to, basically it severed the nerves in my hand, and they couldn't deal with it there. It was the local hospital. So they told me that I would have to go to Roehampton in London, where they specialised in nerve damage. And so I was in there all night, and the next morning I could hear all this commotion outside. I was in a side room, and basically it was my husband had turned up and was demanding to see me, and they knew what he'd done. They wouldn't let him see me, so he was smashing up the ward outside. Eventually they let him in. They all stood around me. I had all these doctors and nurses standing around me. He still had like a white flying jacket on, with all my blood down it. And he was crying and saying, you know, he was sorry. And I just said, it's too late. Everyone knows now, you know, we can't go back now. And again, he ran off, and he went to our doctor's surgery, which was on the estate where we lived. Doctor's surgery happened to be within seeing distance of my parents' house. And my mum actually saw him. By this time, she knew, because my friend had taken my little girl around there about 6 o'clock in the morning. She had to tell them what had happened. And my mum actually saw him pull up in the car and go into the doctor's surgery. So she rang the police and said, look, he's in the doctor's surgery. You need to get him. That's where he is. Unbeknown to me, he apparently had just walked straight into the doctor's room, consulting room, and literally threw the woman out that was in there being seen to by the doctor, and said to the doctor, I need help. I've stabbed my wife. At that point, the police turned up and arrested him. The first I knew of all of this was when I came round from surgery in Roehampton, St. Mary's in Roehampton. And was told that this had all been happening while I was basically having surgery. And he was on remand for about a year. And then he was convicted at the Old Bailey of rape and of GBH with intent and with ABH. So it was the broken nose, the stabbing, and the rape on Christmas morning. It was cut at that point. I didn't need to go to give evidence, because he changed his plea right at the last moment. He pleaded guilty. But what he did say was that that he'd found me in bed with three of his friends. At the time, I was quite pleased that I didn't need to give evidence, because I was very scared. I didn't know what really understand what was going on. Since then, I've thought, I wish I had my day in court, you know, because I could have told them and I didn't get that chance. But he was sentenced to 6.5 years at the Old Bailey, and to my knowledge, he was the first husband to be convicted of rape. And that kind of went through a few years later. I think it became law that could happen. It was quite a difficult one to, I don't know if they would have been found guilty of that, to be honest, if he hadn't have changed his plea. It's hard at the best of times now, you know. It, back then, it surely would have been even harder. But that was it. He changed his plea, and he got 6.5 years. So, yeah, long story. Need a drink, excuse me.
I've made a real point of not interrupting that account because it is unbelievable. So I just did not want to interrupt you because that is an incredible story. And I'm just feeling what you were going through. So I don't know what it was like to actually experience it at the time. A couple of questions for me. Just want to take you back to when he takes over the vehicle on the M3 and he's obviously taking you to that service station. One of the things that sort of sprung into my mind, and I think it's springing into the minds of the audience, is you said that your daughter obviously was in the back of the car.
Yeah.
So question for me is, when he raped you, was your daughter present?
Yes, she was. She was watching, yeah.
And was she awake?
Yes. Yes, she was.
Wow. So one of my other questions was, and we talk a lot about this on the podcast, is we talk a lot about the impact that domestic abuse has on young children and how that trauma can, you know, create problems for them in later life. You know, what are your views on that? What do you think around, you know, the trauma that children experience when they are, you know, caught up in these abusive relationships?
Well, unfortunately, that wasn't the end of it for her, really, although it should have been. When he, shortly after he was sentenced, he took me to court for contact with her, and the court gave him that contact and basically forced me to take her to prison to see him on contact visits. And I was very clearly told by the judge that if I did not do that, then I would be in trouble. I would be in breach of that court order. Of course, he didn't really want to see her. He wanted to get at me, you know, and see me. But it's very sad that my daughter's earliest memory is of a prison, to be honest. When he came out of prison, she was close on, I think she was 6 years old, because he didn't do the whole 6.5 years. It, you know, he'd been on remand for a year and then had time taken off. And for a while, it was supervised contact. And then I was kind of persuaded to drop that and let him have an on. The social services weren't involved at all. I actually went to social services and asked for support, and they said I didn't need it. So I had literally no one to help me. And I didn't know of any, and no one told me of anyone that could help me. So I very begrudgingly said, okay, he can have unsupervised contact. And that went on for probably about 5 years. She never really liked going, but she went. But that, over a period of time, her behaviour became really difficult. She became quite aggressive herself. And when she was 11, I went into her bedroom to do something, make the bed, whatever. And she had a whiteboard in there, and she'd written on it, I want to die. So, wow, I thought, okay, this isn't right. So I took her to the doctor straight away. And the doctor asked to speak to her on her own. So I left the room, and she told the doctor that on contact visits, he was physically abusing her and emotionally abusing her. And the form that took was she would get up to go to the toilet. He would say, no, you're not getting up. You're not going to the toilet until I tell you you're going to the toilet. And she would hang on, and then she would wet herself, and then he would hit her because she'd wet herself. That's that sort of thing. And then, of course, it all went. The doctor said, you need to go to court. You need to get this contact stopped. So I went to a solicitor. I went back to court. I had the contact stopped. Eventually, the court stopped his contact. It was too late. By then, she'd been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, because she remembered and she had flashbacks of that night in the service station, amongst other incidents. And had to see a child psychologist for months, and she was on antidepressants for a while. And, you know, it was all a little bit too late to stop it, you know, but nobody listened to me at the time when it may not have damaged her as much. So, yeah, it's and to be honest, she's 35 now. She's got two children of her own, and she's a fantastic mum, but it has left her, I think she would agree with me, very wary of relationships, very wary of the men she enters relationships with. And she can't trust them because of him. But, you know, where's he? Yeah, you know, he's just living his life wherever he's there. I know where he is, but I'm not going to say. But, you know, just living his life and doing whatever he wants to do. And putting it behind him, you know. So the impact on children is something that I've always felt really, really strongly about, because I know how it impacted on my child, you know.
Yeah, that just sums it up for me, Sharon. At the end of the day, is exactly what I'm saying. And I think this is why, you know, sometimes when we see, in particular boys, I'm not saying always boys, but I think when you see them sort of later on in life, you know, displaying violent tendencies, I think some of it, you know, is learnt behaviour, isn't it?
Yes, it is, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I can't say, you know, his upbringing wasn't great, and he's spent some time in the care system. I don't think it was learned behaviour from anything he witnessed, even though he didn't have a very stable upbringing. But it was definitely... it was definitely a power and control thing for him.
Did he prior to meeting you, and I appreciate you were both quite young, but had he sort of been arrested before for violent related stuff? You know, now, you know, obviously you probably didn't know that at the time, but what was his history like?
Yeah, it was, he had a list as long as your arm, as my mum would have said, of kind of fighting, sorting police officers, that sort of thing. I mean, he was 2 years older than me, so he was, I think it was about 21 when we got married. Yeah, he was very young, yeah. But yeah, he had quite a lot of previous. But not violence towards women, funnily enough. But since, I know that he's done it since to women, but I think I was kind of the first woman that he was violent to.
Just an incredible story, as I've said already, you know, and leads on really to your life now and how you are helping a number of people to tackle this horrendous crime, you know, that goes on in a lot of families within not only just the UK, but across the world. So tell me about your work with the the National Centre for Domestic Violence. I worked with them quite extensively when I was in the police. But there'll be some of our audience that don't know about them. Can you tell us about the work there?
Yeah. So I've known about the National Centre for Domestic Violence for years and actually used them in my job. I worked in Westminster for 16 years and used them often in the last sort of 10 years for female clients that I had. So the National Centre for Domestic Violence specializes in obtaining protective orders, so non-molestation orders, occupation orders, and prohibited steps orders. But predominantly they deal with non-molestation orders. And the organisation was started from a guy called Steve Connor, and he was practising law at the Guildford University. And let me just check my notes, because I'm sure I don't want to get this wrong. And a friend of his needed a non-molestation order, but they couldn't get legal aid. And they were told that it would cost in the regions of a couple of thousand pounds. And so he thought, that's not right. So he started up NCDV. And that is why we exist, really, is to help the people that for whatever reason can't get legal aid. And you know, have no recourse to public funds or work and are above the threshold for getting legal aid. So and we will go, we have a pro bono department, and when a call comes through to what we call our first steps team, they will do an assessment of that person and see if they are entitled to legal aid. If they are, then they'll be allocated a solicitor who will do the work that's needed and take their statement. If they aren't eligible for legal aid, they're passed on to our pro bono department and they will help them. So effectively, they're then a litigant in person, but they will be helped and supported with their statement and all the paperwork, the bundle, if you like, that they need to go into court to get that order.
And so basically, I mean, I know the police do a lot of referrals as well, but if somebody wanted to contact NCDV, what routes can they take to, is there a contact number they can phone?
Yeah, there's several different ways of referring. And of course, people can self-refer. So we also take referrals from male victims, so female and male victims. There's an app that you can download for free that you can refer. Using the app, there is online, there's Refer Direct. On the front page, on the home page of the NCDV website is that form, that referral form. You can text as well, and you can call. And four or five different ways you can refer into NCDV. And last year, I think, pretty sure, we had 95,000 referrals from the police and from other domestic abuse support agencies. And of that, obviously, for one reason or another, they don't all go on to go to court. Some people change their mind, you know, for various different reasons. But of that amount of referrals, we secured just under 10,000 non-molestation orders for people. And of that amount, about 4,100 were people that could not get legal aid, so would have otherwise fallen through the gaps.
That's fantastic. I mean, it's just such a great charity. And as I say, I know from my own personal experience, I would literally refer somebody, say on a night shift or on a late shift, and I know that they may contact more or less straight away the next day. Yeah. They are absolutely amazing. I just couldn't believe. And one thing I always used to like about you guys as well, I'd always get an email to update me on what was going on as well, to a point which I thought was brilliant.
Throughout the whole process, there are certain points in the process that are kind of trigger points where emails or text messages will be sent to not only the victim, but also the referrer to say, okay, we've got this far now, and we've been allocated to a solicitor now, the statement's been done. So each of these points, so they always know, the victim always knows as well at what point they are at in the process. We've also got the ASSIST database. I don't know whether you ever use that, but it's
Tell us about that.
It's basically it's a database that holds all of the orders on there and the certificates of service on there as well. So if what normally happens, I'm sure you'll know that, you know, police are called maybe in the middle of the night, they go out. The victim may say, look, I've got an injunction. I can't find my paperwork, but I've got an injunction. Then the police have to try and find this injunction to be able to see the power of arrest, to make the arrest. And that is kind of just fraught with so many problems. So the ASSIST database holds all of the orders, or all of the orders that we've done anyway. So the police can just go back to the police station, log into the database, and they can then print that order off. They can see it's been served on the perpetrator, and that's it. They've got what they need to make an arrest.
That's fantastic. I didn't know about that. How long's that been in?
I I don't quote me on this. I don't know. I think it's a fair while, but I've only been there since January, so I'm still kind of really learning brilliant. The ropes there.
Yeah, because I've obviously dealt with a lot of civil injunctions, and it is very frustrating sometimes. I mean, you don't always physically need the paperwork, but I tell you what, that's very, very useful to actually see the order and also see the certificate of service, which is so important, you know, if you know, to sort of you know, guarantee that that order is live.
Yeah,
so that's really important. Fantastic work.
So my role is a new role, so really it's I'm just developing it, really, to kind of forge partnerships and with other organisations, not just domestic abuse support services, but any other organisations that come into contact with people that are experiencing domestic abuse in their role, you know, so housing and all those sorts of places, and just trying to sort of raise awareness of us, and being that sort of my story, if you like, started with that non-molestation order. And if it hadn't have been for that, you know, I don't know, I maybe wouldn't have had that month's breathing space that I had, or had the support that I had from the police. So for me, it's, you know, it's really important and a really vital service for people.
Hugely, yeah. Obviously, we've touched on, you know, you just mentioned there really about it's not always, you know, some people change their minds. Mm. It's not an easy thing, you know. I think it's very easy sometimes for somebody to say, just leave them, you know. It's not that simple, is it, Sharon? You know, no. I just wondered if you could just, you know, touch on that for us and for the audience. You know, what advice would you give to somebody that is experiencing, you know, the kind of stuff that you've been through? Now, what advice would you give them?
I would say that unless you will know when you're ready to leave. And I have always said that if you leave because the police are, you know, trying to persuade you to, or you leave because social services are maybe involved in with your case and they want you to leave, if it's not your time to leave, you'll end up going back. And things will be worse. You has to be the right time for you. I used to have people, you know, friends of mine, just couldn't understand it. They used to say to me, "What's the matter with you? Do you enjoy it? What is wrong with you?" I couldn't answer that question, and I probably still can't. I don't think I can now. It was just, it wasn't the right time for me to do it, and the time when I did it was the right time. People will say to you, you know, why don't you just leave? The question should be, Jim, why does he not stop abusing her or him, you know? Because that question in itself, why don't you just leave, is kind of very victim blaming. You're already, your mind and your brain is already so full of everything. What am I going to do for money? Where am I going to live? Are the kids going to miss him? What will I do? All the problems that come along with leaving, it's just not that simple. Even if you haven't got children, it is not that simple. People think there seems to be this myth that it's free to stay in a refuge. It isn't. They cost a lot of money. In London, they're over £500 a week. Refuges are great, but if you work, you've got to then move area. You've got to give up your job. You can't go into a refuge because you won't get housing benefit because you work. So you're stuck. What do you do? The housing is in a terrible state. All over the country, there's nowhere for councils to move people. There's just so many barriers to leaving an abusive relationship that it almost feels safer to stay, because when they say to you, "If you leave me, I will kill you," that isn't just an idle threat. That could and does happen. And, you know, in the first 3 weeks of the first lockdown, 16 women were killed. normally it's kind of about 2 women on average a week in this country. In the first 3 weeks of the first lockdown, it was 16. So that just gives you some kind of idea about how difficult it is to live with someone like that, you know, and also to leave.
I wanted to ask you that question for that very reason, because I knew the answer you were going to give me, but I think it's really good that it comes from somebody like you that's experienced it, you know, because I want to get that across to professionals today that are listening to this podcast, you know, just how complex a situation and issue it is. And you're absolutely right. It's not that simple. And I also agree with you that all of the victims that I've helped over the years have always been the ones that have made that decision. You know, I haven't made that decision for them because I would never do that for them. They had to make it for themselves. Mm-hmm. When they were ready, they knew when they were ready. And nobody in the world is going to change that decision, are they?
No. I mean, the most common thing I have said to me when I've most of my career, I've worked frontline with women that have experienced domestic abuse. And for the last 11 years, I was co-located with Children's Services. It's, you know, why are they the ones that have to jump through the hoops? Why can't they force him to do programs or do whatever? There needs to be more. The perpetrators need to be held more accountable. Don't ask me how you do that. I don't know. But it feels very unfair to women, as we're talking about sort of women being predominantly the victims of domestic abuse. It feels very unfair to them that they have to be the ones that tell him to leave. They have to be the ones that will not let him in the house. When you've got someone bashing at the door, threatening to kill you, you're going to open the door. You know, you're not going to say, I'm sorry, you know, social services say you can't come in. No, you can't do, you're not going to do that. You're walking on eggshells literally the whole time.
That was going to be my next question, actually. I've always felt, and this was a big one for me when I was in the police as well, was that I honestly didn't think that we did enough to tackle the offenders. You know, there was work obviously going on. And I think what really love about, you know, if there is anything to love about your situation, was that the help and support you actually did get in the 80s, because I think the police weren't particularly good at dealing with domestic violence for a number of years. I think it's a lot better now. But I still sit here today thinking we should do more to try and tackle the offenders.
Yeah, I mean, I think there has recently been some money released from central government to kind of go into more focused work on perpetrator work, perpetrator programs and so forth. And of course that helps hugely, but it doesn't seem enough for me. I mean, I don't know what the answer is, Jim, to be honest.
It's a very complex answer.
It is. I really like the sort of mission, NCDV's mission, if you like, is to make domestic abuse socially unacceptable. Because to eradicate it completely, sadly, I don't think we're ever going to do, because of the society in which we live. But if we can make it socially unacceptable, that's, you know, that will be a big thing too, you know, like we did with, you know, seatbelts and drink driving and all of those things. And it's still going to take a long time. But hopefully, you know, with the new domestic abuse bill that's going through the Lords at the moment, once that comes out, there'll be quite a few things in there that will help, I hope.
No, I totally agree with you. I think, you know, there does need to be that, you know, a stigma attached. You know, if you are a domestic abuse offender, whether you're male or female, there has to be that kind of that stigma attached to it, like you've said. And that's how I think it will be a massive help to changing how people, you know, in society view it. And I think that's got to be a good thing. So I think, you know, people like us have just got to keep raising awareness and doing what we can. And I think, you know, if we can all collaborate, you know, we can make steps in the right direction, in my opinion. We've all got to work together on this.
Absolutely. Yeah, we do.
Just before we wrap up the interview, I just wanted to touch on the great work that you do with the Freedom Programme as well, because I know that's kind of a bit of a volunteering sort of role that you do as part of your community interest company. Tell us a bit about the Freedom Programme and how people could potentially access it.
So the Freedom Programme was developed by Pat Craven, who used to be a probation officer and who saw that there was a gap in, you know, service provision. She developed the Freedom Programme many years ago now, and it's now kind of rolled out all over the country. I was very, very lucky to have been trained to facilitate the Freedom Programme by Pat herself in 2014-2015. And it was something that I facilitated when I worked in Westminster with women whose children were on child protection plans or child in need plans. And since working at NCDV, I've carried that on, but in my own time, sort of through my community interest company. So the program is 11 weeks, usually around 11 weeks long. Each session is an hour and a half. And we go through kind of with the thing, we talk about the dominator. So it doesn't have to be, women don't have to sort of tell their personal stories if they don't want to. My experience is within 2 or 3 weeks, they're all talking about their own experiences, but they don't have to do that. So we talk about the dominator. We talk about sort of what are the tactics that he uses. So the dominator has sort of several different personas that he can bring to the fore to be abusive. And one's the bully. Then we might have the head worker. The head worker is pretty much coercive control. The sexual controller, the jailer. And we each week is kind of dedicated to one of these personas of the dominator, and we talk about what tactics will he display, what would we see in a prospective jailer, what are his beliefs, where does he get those beliefs from, and how are we as women, how are we affected by the jailer? And then we always talk about the opposite of the jailer or the opposite of the bully, which would be the opposite of the bully would be the friend. So we always talk about that and a healthy relationship as well. I personally find that, since the pandemic, obviously, all the programs have had to go online. In a way, that's good, though, because you don't have to kind of just take women from the area in which you're living. You can take, you can take women from up in Scotland or Yorkshire. One of the facilitators, Rachel, who I believe you know, she even has women from abroad.
Yeah, Rachel Williams, yeah.
Yeah. So the biggest thing for me, the most common sort of feedback I get is that women feel that they're not alone. They feel that they can share their stories and that other women will understand and will listen and believe them. And for them, that's very empowering. I do that out of work time in the evenings. I love it. And for me, it's just very, very... It's very empowering just for seeing from the first session through to the last session, watching women become stronger.
Watching them grow.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And again, it's like what we talked about earlier, that even though you guys are not saying, this is the point you've got to leave, I think what that's going to do is it's going to give them the confidence to make that decision, when the time is right.
Exactly. And the Freedom Programme gives women the tools that they need to identify abusive behaviour. And I have had women that have done the programme that have started the programme and they've still been with the the person, and it's helped them to make that decision to leave. It's never something that we, that I or any of the other facilitators would force on anyone. It's totally up to them if they come. If they don't want to come, that's fine too. If they want to skip weeks, it's down to them. But it's the empowerment that they get from being with other women that have had similar experiences to them.
Absolutely fantastic program. How can people link in to the Freedom Program? Obviously, I've taken it runs all over the UK. So how can people link in?
Well, they if they head over to the Freedom Program website, which you type Freedom Program into Google, that has on it a program, and you will get lists of everybody that's doing programs, including me, on there. We all do them at different times, different days of the week. Sometimes some are in the day, some are in the evening, some are at the weekends. And you can just count, all of them are being done by Zoom at the moment. And you just contact that person, their contact details are there.
Does it cost anything?
No, absolutely free.
So it's all free.
Never ever charge. I fundraise through my community interest company to be able to run the programs. And no, none of us ever charge anybody to do the Freedom Program.
Thanks for that information, Sharon. Sharon, we're coming towards the end now. Is there anything you wanted to cover today that we haven't covered yet? You know, like a question I haven't asked you.
I don't think so. I can't think of anything.
Wanted to thank you for being so open and honest with me today. It's an incredible journey that you've come on. But I just think about all the people that you're helping and, you know, how you are. I always talk about one person can make a difference. And you're just, you know, testament to that, that one person can make a difference. So, you know, the more of us that sort of, you know, get involved with tackling domestic abuse like yourself, the more we're going to go towards, you know, at least reducing it significantly over the next few years.
I always get asked a lot, why do I do this job? And my answer is, it's a bit cheesy, but my answer is always the same, that I do it. I try to be the person that I wish had been there for me and wasn't. Because it's a very, very lonely place when you don't know who to talk to, you don't know if you'll be believed, and you can be in a room full of people and feel like you're the only person in there. So that has always been my answer. If when people ask me why I do this job, it is to be the person, to try to be the person that I wish I'd have had when it happened to me.
It's like a lot of people say, you know, people never really know what's going on behind closed doors, do they?
That's very true, yeah.
You know, you can go to a party and, you know, potentially the perpetrator can be the life and soul of the party and everybody loves them, but actually nobody really knows truly what goes on behind that closed door.
Nope. The sort of classic perpetrator of domestic abuse is a lovely guy or girl, and they will do anything for anyone. You never really know what somebody is like.
Sharon, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's I've immensely enjoyed the information that you've given, and I'm sure when the audience listen to this, they are going to get an awful lot from it. So thank you from me and also from the audience. Thank you also to the audience today for listening to the Community Safety Podcast. Please like, rate, and subscribe to the Community Safety Podcast. We really do want to spread our message across to as many people as possible. So tell your friends, tell your colleagues. Let's get as many people on board in changing communities in the 21st century. And we'll catch you on the next episode. Whoa, that interview with Sharon Bryan absolutely blew me away today. It's so important that we raise more and more awareness around domestic abuse, what people go through, and also how they can get the appropriate help and support to break away from abusive relationships. Can't thank Sharon enough for, you know, sharing that horrific story with us. so hopefully we can help save others. Thank you so much again for listening to the Community Safety Podcast. We really do appreciate you listening in. Please like, rate and subscribe to the Community Safety Podcast. We really want to get our mission across to as many people as possible. Please tell your friends, please tell your colleagues, and we'll catch you on the next episode.
You've been listening to the Community Safety Podcast. With thanks for support from St Ives Chambers, RHE Global and Me Learning. Join us again next time to help us explore how we can transform our communities in the 21st century on the Community Safety Podcast with Jim Nixon.